This is the World Vegan Travel Podcast, Season 2, Episode 15. I'm Bridie, one of the founders of World Vegan Travel Tours, and the World Vegan Travel Podcast is all about showing you how you might explore this world as a vegan. We do different types of episodes. We share our vegan travel experiences and the experiences of others to inspire you to get out into this beautiful world. And we conduct interviews with people doing amazing things to promote vegan travel, as well as individuals and organizations that are protecting human and non-human animals in a destination you could be visiting. So let's get right into it. I am really excited to introduce you to Lucas Spiegel. He is the author of a newly released book called Weight of Empathy. This travel memoir is all about what happens when you leave everything and everyone you know behind, take a one-way flight across the ocean, and continue by foot, train, bus, rickshaw, motorbike, and ferry until you circled the earth. That's what Lucas Spiegel decided to find out in early 2016. What started as an ambitious plan to travel the world for 22 months became a transformative exploration of our relationship with animals, food, and each other. The story of this journey makes for an impassioned and personal, yet thoroughly reasoned plea for a kinder, more just, and merciful world. I know that this sounds very interesting to the audience of this podcast. A long trip like this, like the one that Lucas undertook, is a dream, a distant dream for so many of us. And his style of travel is really very attractive indeed. In this podcast, we talked about how such a trip is possible by staying for a long time and traveling on a budget, as well as the highlights of this trip. My own perspective is this book is really very beautiful and would make such a wonderful gift for any vegans in your life that love to travel and anyone who appreciates beautiful travel photography and thoughtful reflections. I really recommend you go to weightofempathy.com for more information. Before we get started, a quick word from our sponsor. Of course, that sponsor is us, World Vegan Travel. So some of you might know that we have a trip to Italy planned, Tuscany to be specific, for October this year, and it's going to be amazing. We're going to be staying at a beautiful all-vegan hotel right next to the UNESCO village of San Gimignano. Those G's in Italian are rather tricky, let me tell you. We actually had a podcast interview with one of the managers from these hotels a while ago, and I will link it in the show notes, and of course you can see some pictures, but this hotel is really, really something. I really encourage you to go and check them out online to see where we're going to be staying. This hotel is definitely a lot smaller than hotels that most people stay in, and they're even a lot smaller than some of the hotels that we usually stay in. Even though we always try to choose boutique hotels, this one is even smaller than that. And because we'll be taking over the whole place, the group size for this trip is actually smaller than they normally are, and we are already half full. So contact us today to ask any questions you might have about this trip that we are hosting in collaboration with Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. I will link an adorable video from Agrivia Ipini in the show notes, because through my words, I cannot do it justice. I should also add that we are intending to visit the sanctuary that Lucas visited, that he talks a little bit about his in our interview today and also in his book. So yeah, you can visit this sanctuary too. So let's chat more with Lucas Spiegel. Hello, Lucas. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited to have you on the podcast today, because you are such an amazing fit for our podcast. Not only have you done so much travel, but you've actually written and created a beautiful book about this trip that you did. So Lucas, please, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and your amazing trip that you did throughout the world, actually?
Sure. So I am from Oregon, at least lived here the last 20 years or so, and I went to school here for architecture, worked around the world in architecture for a handful of years, including a year in India and 3 years in Canada. And from there, I ended up taking a life-changing around the world trip that was kind of a long time in the making, and kind of changed the course of my life and spurred me to write this book and eventually come on this podcast.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's amazing. So, for those people that haven't read the book yet, and of course, we're going to be linking absolutely everything down in the show notes there, but tell us a little bit about your trip because it really is a lot more than just a 2 week holiday in the sun. It's so much more than that. Can you tell us?
Sure. So just to give a little context of how I kind of came about, this trip came about. I was living in Vancouver, BC, and I had saved a little money for the first time in my life. I had decided for a couple of reasons not to stay in Vancouver. So I had no job. I was needed to stick around for nothing sort of tying me down. And I started thinking about my long-term goals and aspirations and looked at the list and realized a lot of those things were actually places in the world I wanted to go and people around the world I wanted to see again. So I started scheming this trip where basically instead of working a regular job and if I'm lucky, I get to take a 2 week vacation at some point in the year and can go to some far off location. And in those 2 weeks, probably barely get over jet lag and get a taste of the place. Instead, I figured if I had all of these places I wanted to go, I could kind of just head west and keep going from there until I got all the way back around the world. And it would be much easier and more realistic for me to actually go to all of these places that I wanted to go, and some I had no idea that I wanted to go until I got there. So that's how it started. It ended up being about 2 years of planning, and by the time I actually left, my plan had expanded from about maybe a year-long trip to a year to a year and a half outline. And then by the time I actually finished the trip, I ended up traveling for nearly 2 years around the world. So that's kind of the outline. I basically went from the west coast of the US to Australia, up to Japan, and then through Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and Myanmar, and then returned to India, to Sri Lanka, and then I went to Europe where I spent time in France, Spain, Italy, Germany, the Netherlands, and Denmark, and had a little detour there to Israel and Egypt as well before coming back to the States. So it was a very wide-ranging trip with a huge diversity of experience. And yeah, it took me then about 2 full years after getting back to really synthesize everything and put it into a book, including selecting from among the 17,000 photographs I took on the way.
Right. I'm not surprised. I've had the privilege of being able to read and look through the book and the photography. I was saying to you before we started recording, the photography is just beautiful. It's just really simple and authentic and really captures the charm of the place or the subject that you're taking a picture of. So well done there.
Thank
Now,
you.
the trip itself, the places that you went to were kind of interesting to me because, from what I could tell, and maybe you left some of these bits out because it's not so relevant, let me know.
Okay.
But it's not really sort of a going around and partying and going to the Thai beaches and full moon parties and all of these kinds of things that we normally associate with this sort of taking a gap year or longer travel or backpacker budget travel. Yours was quite different. It had a real structure to it in terms of the things that you did. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was a particular style of travel, which, you know, kind of aligns with my sensibilities and my priorities and my interests. But it wasn't a vacation exactly. Mm. There were certainly times in the trip, many times when I was exhausted and homesick, and, you know, I took a few days or a week on a beach somewhere and kind of just rejuvenated and relaxed. But for the most part, I really saw it as a huge privilege for me to be able to actually spend time in another person's country, in another person's community, and often in another person's home where they live. And so for me to kind of take that for granted and treat it as a kind of just a holiday party instead of really taking the opportunity to learn about them and their culture and their home would have been, I think, a huge wasted opportunity. So the actual style of travel, it varied quite a bit depending on where I was, depending on my budget. So it was everything from staying in comfortable hotels to sleeping in a camper van to couch surfing or working for room and board, or as I'm sure we'll get into, volunteering at animal sanctuaries.
Right. Yeah. And let's talk about those animal sanctuaries, actually, because you volunteered at so many of them. And I know that's something that a lot of vegan travelers really worry about when they are looking to go and visit places where they might inadvertently go and volunteer at a place which is exploiting animals, or it's not what they seem to be as a legit animal sanctuary. And you went to so many. So how did you locate and reach out to these places that wanted volunteers? Because I noticed that you went to Elephant Nature Park and did some volunteering there. Of course, they have a very yes. robust, and they're very well known, a very robust, popular, from what I can tell, volunteer program. But there are all of these other sanctuaries that you also went to. So how did you sort of vet, for want of a better word, these sanctuaries to make sure that they were aligned with what you wanted to do? And then kind of organize it, for example, was language a barrier, or did you have to commit to a certain amount of time?
Right. It varies quite a bit, as you can imagine. I mean, one of the things that I wrote about in my book, having had the opportunity to visit all of these different animal sanctuaries, is that most people kind of stumble into it. They don't really set out with this grand plan to start an animal sanctuary and then spend months or years planning and fundraising and building before they adopt their first animal. They kind of make the decision at some point and end up bringing in a rescued animal, and the floodgates kind of flip wide open. And there, once you have your doors open to rescued animals, there's no shortage of those who need your help. So a lot of people are just trying to learn as they go along, and, you know, some are much older and more established, and some have really well laid out volunteer programs, and others have few to no volunteers ever even know where they are or come by to help. So it's just a sort of one-on-one communication and negotiation of, you know, figuring out how to make it work. So it was kind of a thing that evolved as my trip went on, and became not only a focus of my trip, but a focus of the book and a focus of the philanthropic project that I started when I got back from my trip. But when I first left, my thought was to actually write a cookbook when I got back, kind of collecting vegan recipes from around the world and also using that as an opportunity to write about and sort of share the personalities, the people that I met, their stories in a book. So that was kind of my thought of a sort of longer term project I could work on throughout my trip. But as things went on, actually the first sanctuary that I went to on my trip was completely accidental. I was working for room and board on this small permaculture farm in Tasmania, Australia, and my host was driving me around the countryside, and I actually saw a billboard for Brightside Farm Animal Sanctuary. And I was thinking, that is so crazy.
Ears pricked up, and you quickly did a Google search. I'm sure that's what
Yeah,
happened.
exactly. And so I was, lucky enough to be able to at least go for a day visit and do a little volunteering and meet the animals there. And it is one of the most amazing sanctuaries I've been to, even though it was just for a day. Emma, the woman who runs it, is one of these incredible just people. You don't know how they get as much done as they get done. She has one day per week. She doesn't allow anybody else on the sanctuary. And it's not to take a break from the work. It's to take a break from just dealing with humans, but she still
Right.
does all of the work on that, on her like sort of day off, to take care of the hundreds of animals who live there. So that was a really lucky thing. And then I ended up just kind of more and more searching it out. I had heard about Elephant Nature Park before. A good friend of mine had traveled there and told me about it. So I knew they had a good reputation, and of course, I was thrilled at the opportunity to work with elephants and meet elephants in an ethical way. And so, as I traveled, I kind of just Googled and asked around for sanctuaries that I might be able to visit. Sometimes it was as simple as, ending up in a big city in India or Southeast Asia and hearing about some dog rescue that operates there, sterilizing stray dogs and things like that, being able to visit them. Sometimes it was weeks or months in advance when I would arrange with a sanctuary for like a longer term stay with them. I stayed for a few weeks at a sanctuary in Italy and another one in Spain and another one in Denmark. And so those sorts of things all had to be arranged beforehand.
Right. Yeah, I have to say I was really excited when I read about your visit to the Italian sanctuary, Ippiosca or something like that. Is that the name of it?
Ippowassi.
Ippowassi, that's right.
Yeah,
And the
yeah.
reason
It's
why go ahead.
I was just gonna say it's one of the more kind of, it's not urban, but it's only, 10, 15 minutes outside the city of Pisa. So they get a lot of visitors there, and it's an amazing place, amazing people. But they also have sort of a unique situation where they're able to share that experience with the rescued animals with, thousands of people a year because they live in a relatively well-traveled location.
Well, I was so interested to hear about this particular sanctuary, and because Seb and I, my partner and I, we're hoping to run a trip to Italy next year in the Tuscany region. And we had done quite a lot of Googling and searching for possible sanctuaries to visit. And
Okay.
because of the language barrier and because of the search terms that we're probably using and the nature of a lot of sanctuaries, they're often very small and they're not. Obviously, of course, why would they necessarily in English? So
Right.
it can be a little bit hard to seek these sanctuaries out, but thanks to your experience there, we're looking to reach out to them to see if we'll be able to visit them when we go to Italy,
Oh, that's
hopefully
great.
this
That's
year.
great. Yeah, that actually is one of the places where the language barrier was surprisingly more challenging at the Italian sanctuary. there were a couple of people there who were pretty fluent in English, but I don't speak any Italian, and many of the people there spoke pretty pretty moderate English and weren't that comfortable using it. So that was a bit of a challenge. And yeah, it can be a challenge if you're trying to find a place in a foreign country and, you know, if they're not advertising themselves in English, then that can be a barrier. But yeah, that would be amazing if you visit. You'll have to say hello to my little wild boar friend.
Very cute. Yeah.
Keep this echo.
I sent the name of the sanctuary to Seb, and he said, "Oh, that's so cool. I wanted to put Pisa on the itinerary, but needed something to make it extra special." So
one of the best vegan restaurants that I've eaten at was in Livorno, I believe, which is just south of Pisa.
Oh, okay.
Called La Casina di Alice. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. It's spelled like Alice. But it is incredible. It's like kind of high-end, fancy, fine dining, but actually remarkably affordable considering, and yeah, some of the most amazing food I've eaten.
Oh my goodness. Well, I will link to that on the show notes, and I will definitely tell Seb about that. That sounds totally perfect for our trip. So out of all of the places that you went to, Australia, Japan, and I'm wondering if I can guess what it is, but where was your favorite destination out of all of the places and the countries you visited? Or maybe perhaps the better question is, which country surprised you the most?
There are, as you can imagine, there are multiple answers to the question. One of the places that's one of my favorite, as you might be able to guess having read the book, is this little village in western Japan.
I knew it.
I lived with a family for 2 weeks there, and doing sort of work exchange for room and board. And before I left the country, I came back to them, and I stayed for another 2.5 weeks because I fell in love with the place and the people there, the family I was living with. Was just, yeah, a really incredible experience. I met a lot of expats, obviously, all around, and many in Japan are teaching English abroad. And I was suggesting to them, you know, you get a lot of time off, you get a week or two off at a time, you should go and do like work exchange and live in some local, you know, Japanese family's home in the countryside. And it's just such an incredible privilege to be able to, like I said, live in somebody else's home and really kind of absorb and learn about them and their culture and how they live. It's really an incredible opportunity. So I started out doing this because I couldn't afford to travel in Australia for 3 months at a time and Japan for 3 months at a time just out of pocket. That adds up really fast. So I was thinking, well, there are these networks that you can use, woofing, worldwide opportunities on organic farms, and Help Exchange or HelpX are two great resources to connect you with host families. And so it was partly budgetary reasons that I started out on that route. And, you know, as you can see, they ended up being some of the highlights of my trip. So long-winded answer, and that's only part one of the answer. This village in Western Japan was one of my favorites. I really was surprisingly taken with Myanmar, actually. Mm-hmm. I spent a month traveling around Myanmar, which was the longest tourist visa you could get at the time. And it's a beautiful country. I mean, just the natural beauty, and, you know, it's a heavily Buddhist population, and there are just incredible Buddhist temples, and the food is, Absolutely incredible as well. And the people I found to be the thing that struck me the most is just how playful they seemed. It was a big enough difference between other places I'd been that it really stuck out. Just people kind of laughing around with their families, just roughhousing with their friends, and smiling. I don't want to I don't want to kind of glorify poverty or anything like that, which I know can be a temptation for people to think, oh, they have so little, but they're so happy, and they are enduring real struggles. But I did find their culture to be just refreshingly kind of playful and happy. So it's definitely heartbreaking to hear about the situation there with the military coup that happened recently, and taking some st serious steps back from democracy and all of the violence. I still am in touch with a few people who I met and stayed with in Myanmar, so I've been keeping in touch with them and checking on them, but it's truly heartbreaking. Really an amazing country, and I hope that they come out the other side soon.
Yes, I agree. I went to Myanmar for 10 days a long time ago now, nearly 20 years ago, and I was just really surprised by just how friendly and kind and playful is such a great adjective to describe the people. I remember meeting one young woman at Shawedagon Pagoda, and we just ended up hanging out all day. And even though we could hardly understand each other, we just had such a wonderful time. Yeah, Myanmar, really nice. It's I guess visiting there right now would not be recommended for many reasons, but
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
definitely worth putting on the list when hopefully it will be soon, things calm down. These volunteering opportunities that you did, how did you work out how to navigate that there would be vegan food available? Because of course this can be an issue because they'll be providing food for you a lot of the time. And I know this probably would be a real sticking point for many vegans who were thinking about volunteering in this way.
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, first of all, don't let it hold you back. It's not as hard as you might think. And my other suggestion would be just to be upfront and respectfully blunt about your needs as early as possible in the process, whether it's your first email to someone inquiring about opportunities, or you meet some local on the street who invites you to their home for tea or something like that. The earlier that you can just, respectfully and, politely tell them that you're vegetarian and you also don't eat dairy and eggs, the better. And I think a lot of people are really worried about offending people by declining food that is offered to them. But my experience has been that if you are just respectful and communicative about it, then I've never had a problem. I think the only problem comes when people are feel entitled about it. If you come into somebody's home and then you're demanding that they make something else special for you, that would be offensive. If you just say, oh, no, thank you, I'm full, or if you're unexpectedly offered something, then they might be disappointed that you didn't take it because they wanted to share their food with you, but that's about the extent of it. So with a lot of these, some of these opportunities, like the woofing and the help exchange, I would specifically search on the websites for vegan or vegan-friendly hosts. So that kind of limited my options somewhat, but as you can see, there were still plenty of opportunities for me.
So you were able to filter the results?
Yeah, with the different websites are all have their strengths and weaknesses. So the woofing thing is usually each country will have their own independent website. And so some of them you can filter really specifically, like is completely vegan, is not vegan, but is willing to cook vegan, or like most of the meals are vegan and can accommodate vegans. And it's really this sort of fine-tuned filtering. And some of them, you know, you just have to do a general keyword search for vegan or vegetarian. And, you know, half of the results might be someone saying in their description, this is not the place to come if you don't eat meat. and then the other, you know, there's others that are saying, you know, we're happy to accommodate vegans, or we're vegan ourselves.
Yeah. And I'm guessing you can probably put it on your profile as well.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. Gosh, things have changed. I remember joining, although I never actually did it, I remember joining Woof, gosh, a really long time ago, maybe more than 20 years ago. And you were sent this little book of the place, of the country that you wanted to go to. And often you had to write them a letter because they were farms and they were in the middle of nowhere and they often didn't have a phone line, let alone internet. So yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was interesting. Actually, in Australia, I ended up using Help Exchange instead of the woofing system, partly because at the time, and this was not that long ago, at the time they still did not have like a searchable database on the Australian woofing website. They still created a physical copy of a book, like directory every year, and yeah, so it was not a great system. So with Help Exchange and these other woofing websites, the really key part of it is not only can you search for a host that is compatible with you and is a good fit, but you can also look at testimonials from past woofers. And so you can see, you know, if there's a handful of people who are saying, oh, these people are just trying to find free labor and they were disrespectful and we left in the middle of the night or something, then you can avoid them. And then there's others that say, oh, these people are like family and, you know, I can't wait to come back. And so that really helps because you are kind of putting yourself out there. As much as you try and plan ahead, you kind of ultimately end up, as I said in my book, you're in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, at somebody's home, sort of at their mercy. And so to be able to have these like references on the website is a total game changer in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. I this is super important for people who might be nervous about going to a place like a farm in the middle of nowhere without knowing anything about that person. Yeah, really. Really cool.
And actually, Help Exchange, I'll just mention also, Help Exchange, or Help, the letter X, is great because they also have a like a forum where you can post for other travelers. If you're looking for someone who maybe has a tip about how to get to a certain place, or I even found another traveler, a German woman, who was looking to go on a road trip up the east coast of Australia at the same time. And we ended up sharing a camper van, which was
nice,
kind of adventurous on both our parts, but worked out really well. And so, yeah, that can also be a good resource just to connect with other travelers.
Mm. So Lucas, this trip of 22 months, I mean, it just sounds epic. And when I think about how much money I have spent in the past on 1 week of travel, I'm hoping that your trip was not 100 times more expensive than that. I'm sure it wasn't due to this type of travel that you did. But are you able to sort of give a sort of a rough ballpark in how much a day or a month this kind of travel costs?
Yeah, sure. I'm not independently wealthy, but I did have the luck and the privilege to have saved some money working in architecture, and had even been blessed enough to be able to pay off my student loans beforehand. So
That's a big one.
I did have some saved money to give me some flexibility, but I was traveling on a pretty strict low budget, and my strategy for that, I don't know how much it makes sense it makes to other people, but for me it's the only thing that I could come to. I set a daily budget, regardless of where I was in the world, and then I adapted my travel style depending on how expensive things were in the country where I was. So as I was referring to earlier, in Australia and Japan, that meant about two-thirds of the time that I was in the country, I was, staying, working for room and board or couch surfing or that sort of thing. In a place like Vietnam, which was my next destination after Japan, I was able to stay in hotels and, eat at restaurants every day, for probably less than I was spending in Japan, including the woofing homestays. So, at the end, I did the math, and it came out to about $800 per month, including airfare, which I am still impressed that I was able to travel on that low of a budget. I did travel in a lot of countries that are pretty inexpensive, and I did spend a lot of time working for room and board, volunteering, a decent amount of time couch surfing, and staying with friends of mine in the places where I had them.
$800 for 1 month. That's pretty impressive. And tell us a little bit about couch surfing because I'm familiar with it because I've done a lot of traveling and I've never been a couch surfing host. I did try to become a couch surfing host at one point and Seb vetoed it because he didn't want strangers in the house, which I guess is fair enough. But what is couch surfing? Because it is
Well,
hugely popular.
yeah, I'm a big advocate for couch surfing. I have hosted couch surfers and couch surfed plenty myself, years ago, just living in communal households, where that was kind of just open households where a friend of a friend would come through town and they would stay on our couch for a night or a few nights. But then with the advent of couchsurfing.com, it kind of changed and opened it up to a whole new community of people. So the benefit, just like with the woofing and health exchange websites, is that you can have references on there from people, friends of the person in question, or people who previously hosted them or were hosted by them. And so you can really be as picky as you want. You might not always find a host if you're super picky, but you can choose to stay with people or host people who only have a large number of positive references. And I've talked to women, for instance, who will only host or be hosted by other women, because as you can guess, there are certainly, people on there who are looking to be ex use it in an exploitive way, with the women who are using it to travel. So you can really, make it work for you in a way that meets your comfort level. And it's great. A lot of people, there's typically no kind of formal exchange of any kind. Often, if you're staying in somebody's home, then it's nice to cook them a meal or things like that, and obviously be as sort of respectful and as little of a burden as possible. Sometimes you're just on the person's couch or on their floor, and they'll be, you know, upfront about what they have available. Sometimes they have a whole, you know, separate bedroom in their, you know, giant flat or whatever it is. And usually they just like to meet people from different parts of the world. And oftentimes either they've experienced that hospitality and they kind of want to pay it back, or they're not able to travel themselves. And so this is their way of getting that kind of cultural exchange and meeting people from different places. So not only is it a good way to save money, but it's really a great way to meet people and to be connected to local communities. This is a bit of a tangent, but I really find it to be so much more worthwhile when I'm able to connect with locals in a place. And that opportunity really presents itself, like, kind of when you make it happen. It's really easy to go traveling and the only locals that you meet are the ones who are working for you, the ones who are cleaning your room and preparing your food and transporting you from one place to another. And it's such a different experience when you can actually just connect with people who live there in a way that is removed from any sort of monetary exchange. And couch surfing is one way to do that.
So how did you feel after this trip, after you got home? I'm sure there was some sort of period of adjustment, and also maybe you felt like you had become changed in some way. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think there's maybe two components of that. The first being this kind of culture shock part of it. And the other is kind of how it actually shifted the course of my life and shifted my perspective on the world and on my role in the world. So the culture shock part, obviously I experienced so many different environments and different cultures throughout the trip that it wasn't so sudden as being in a foreign place and then being back home. So I think one of the interesting effects is something that a good friend of mine talked to me about, and I wrote about in the book, and she called the lonely paradox of travel, which I think is a great expression for it. And it's kind of this idea that the more I had traveled, the more different places I had been and communities I had learned about and been a part of, in a way, I am able to empathize with people more, kind of have a broader connection to, you know, so many people around the world. Mm-hmm. And ironically, that kind of makes it harder to feel like I actually fit in any one of those communities, including the one I came from before I started traveling, because it does change you to travel like this. I didn't set out to travel in order to find myself, as some might think. I'm old enough that I like to think I have a pretty good sense of who I am, or had a pretty good sense before I started. I wasn't straight out of high school or something. But it's impossible to travel that much and be exposed to so much of the world without it changing you in pretty profound ways. Mm-hmm. So I think the main effect, sort of transformative effect of this trip is kind of the core, the thesis of my book, which is essentially rethinking what my role in the world is. And it can be so challenging, you know, more than the language barriers, more than figuring out local forms of public transportation or communicating your dietary needs to people. The biggest challenge is in embracing empathy when you're confronted with so much suffering around the world, human suffering and animal suffering, whether it's the young barefoot child in the streets of a big city in India who's grabbing at your arm and begging for money or food, or if it's the pigs that you see being transported to slaughter, or the sick stray animals on the street. It's tempting to kind of just block that out of your mind and develop a kind of numbness to it, sort of acknowledging the sadness, but kind of keeping that at bay enough so that you can continue on with your life as it was before. And that's really tempting because it can be really debilitating. I mean, there are definitely people who will not travel to many parts of the world because they know how painful it's going to be to see the things that they'll see. So I think the process of traveling, and then after that, the process of synthesizing all of my experiences and putting it into this book, was learning how to embrace that empathy and not turn away, and to convert it into action. And I think that's really the only way. It can be a painful experience, but it is also an empowering and a beautiful experience, because empathy is not just what allows us to feel someone else's pain. It is also what allows us to feel their joy and allows us to connect with them, whether that is other humans or non-human animals in the world.
Yes.
And so if you can embrace that and translate it into action, then that seemed increasingly like the only path forward for me. Mm-hmm. So it changed my perspective in that way, and it changed the course of my life. So when I came back, I didn't go back into architecture. Instead, I started a philanthropic enterprise, which was a vegan dog treat company, where I donated 100% of profits to farm animal sanctuaries. And so I chose one animal at a time at a particular sanctuary and raised enough to donate a lifetime sponsorship for them, and included a postcard with each bag of dog treats, showing that rescued animal exactly where the money was going and sharing their rescue story. So it was a way to connect with animal lovers who may or may not already be vegan. And it was a way to raise funds and awareness, funds for and awareness of these different animal sanctuaries that are doing such incredible and important work. So that, unfortunately, I had to pause that endeavor indefinitely at the end of 2020 due to COVID and just the decimation of the retail sector in that regard. But it was a huge success insofar as it lasted 3 years, and I was able to raise over $13,000 for animal sanctuaries and share the story of rescued animals with thousands of people in the process. And so I'm not really sure where I'm going next, but that is kind of the direction I've dedicated myself to from here on out.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. So what made you decide to write this book about your trip?
Well, part of it was just a way to process my experience. It was a kind of open-ended journaling exercise in a way. Yes. The trip was so intense in so many different ways. There was, you know, I learned so much. I was exposed to so many people and places and cultures and foods that I'd never seen before. You know, I experienced joy and ecstasy and heartbreak and saw so many things that I didn't even fit into my worldview of what was possible in good ways and bad. And it was just so much to process. So part of it was really just putting that all together for my own edification and really kind of crystallizing what I, the sort of process that I was just elaborating on with the direction of my life and how I can live in a meaningful way and how I can embrace empathy without going crazy. So a lot of it was just for my own sanity to figure out what my experience meant for me and for my future. But the way that it kind of developed was also a call to action. It's a pro-vegan book, and there's no, that's not sort of like secret or it's, I'm pretty upfront with that from the beginning. But not so much, it's not really an overview of, oh, these are all of the, this is all the data about the damage to the environment from animal agriculture, and this is specifically what happens in factory farms. There are obviously a huge number of great resources out there for that information. This was more about sharing my own experience, wrestling with these concepts of how can I engage in a world that is often uncaring and merciless in a way that is sort of true to myself and honors all of the people and the animals I've met and during my travels and during my life, and essentially trying to live a life that is of the most benefit that I can muster to the world. And, you know, I hope that other empathetic people will try and do the same. And whether that is, you know, avoiding meat or animal products, or, you know, volunteering some of your time or donating to local sanctuaries or other organizations that are doing good work. I think, again, it's important to translate our empathy into action rather than just feeling bad about bad things. And I hope that that's what people get from it. So in order to process my own experience, I didn't have to get a book made. I just had to write it out. So it's really that sort of call to action that I hope is meaningful to people and spurs people to consider the consequences of their own choices and how they can live kind and meaningful lives. And for that reason, that's why I decided to actually properly publish it and try and get as many copies out in the world as I can.
Well, I can vouch that it is an absolutely beautiful book. I think it would make a really amazing coffee table book, precisely because the pictures are so nice. And I can just imagine it as a really great gift for a vegan or a really great gift for yourself, and to put it on your coffee table. And when your non-vegan friends and guests come and visit, they sort of flick through and maybe take on board some of the beautiful messages that you've put in there.
Thank you. I hope so. I like I said, I didn't sort of sugarcoat what I had to say or sort of conceal my motives for writing and sharing what I did. But I hope that it will be appealing and thought-provoking for anyone who is vegan or just an animal lover or someone interested in travel. So
great.
That's the hope.
So I have a question. If you could turn back time and talk to yourself before the trip, give yourself some friendly advice, what would you tell yourself?
You know, I saw this question in the prep, and honestly, I don't know if there's anything I would tell myself.
That's okay.
I think it was impossible to know what the trip would entail and what the consequences of it would be, and that's kind of the point of it, is like launching myself into the unknown and seeing what happens. And so I'm glad that it was that way.
Fantastic. So Lucas, how is it that people will be able to check out your book and see what it is that you're up to and perhaps order a copy of the book? How might they do that?
Sure. You can order a copy and check out more, including some photographs and sort of a sneak peek of the inside at the book website. That's weightofempathy.com, weightofempathy, weightofempathy.com. You can order it there directly from me. It's $20 a copy, plus shipping and handling. Right now, it's only available in the U.S. unless you desperately need it shipped overseas. Please send me a message and I'm happy to, but the shipping can get quite expensive. You can also follow my Instagram, which is Earth and Eats is my handle, and I'll be posting about the book. And also you can scroll back and see hundreds of interesting photos from all of my travels on there as well.
Amazing. Well, Lucas, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It was lovely talking to you, and I wish you all the best for your next steps.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of the World Vegan Travel Podcast with Lucas Spiegel, and we'll go and check out Lucas's work at weightofempathy.com. If you are interested in learning more about the places and things that we talk about in this podcast, please go to the show notes. And if you would like to listen to more episodes of the World Vegan Travel Podcast, feel free to go to worldvegantravel.com, click on podcast, and check out any of the episodes that sound interesting to you. Thank you so much for listening today. And if you have any comments or suggestions about the podcast, I would love to hear them. Thank you so much, and talk to you next week.